Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Glad to have everybody back for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are new to the show, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room. That's where you can find the usual suspects making their observations on the show. And it's a great place that if you have a question you would really like for us to direct to our guests during the course of the show, go ahead and add it in the chat room. We'll both be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'll do our best to grab those great ideas and fold them in. Also, if you want to catch up on previous episodes, or if you have to pop out halfway through to take care of business and want to see what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. And that's the same way where at the end of the top of the hour, for those that are joining us live, if the show keeps going, the audio dies, but the after show, if we want to finish up with one more question, or we just want to give our guests some more time to flesh out their answer to the last one, that's where you'll find it. And it's up there almost immediately at the archive. But let's get on with the show. So far in 2014, I think the big lesson for a lot of people in the national security arena is what people have known on and off for centuries, is in Eurasia, whether you want to or not, you cannot ignore Russia. And the old cliche is accurate as well, that Russia is never as weak as she seems or as strong as she seems, depending upon which part of the spectrum you're feeling about Russia at that day. And we want to look in 14 so far, what developments have we seen? We've seen, of course, the Crimean crisis has expanded onto mainland Ukraine, Western Europe's response, and the response in a surprisingly unified way with some variations in the former Soviet republics that border on the European Union, and of course those former Warsaw Pact client nations of the Soviet Union that are now part of NATO. And to discuss this and more for the full hour will be a returning guest of ours, our go-to man for all things Russian, Dr. Dmitry Gornberg. He is a senior analyst at CNA Strategic Studies. He is an associate at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. He's an author and also the host of the Must Visit Russian Military Reform blog. Dmitry, welcome back to Midrats. And that's all my fault because I forgot to unmute you. So, Dmitry, sorry about that little technical problem. Welcome back to Midrats.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. Just kind of as a scene setter, I know the couple times we've had you on the show before previously were kind of a, hello, everybody. Everybody's talking about other things. We want to talk about Russia. And I think especially for a Russian expert as yourself and a lot of people who similarly have a lot of background and intellectual effort invested in helping people understand Russia and her near abroad, 2014 has been an interesting year with probably a lot more phone calls and emails. Just from your perspective as somebody who specializes in Russia and the near abroad and the concerns with her, what are some of the top shelf items in 2014 that you've been focused on, and also maybe one or two items that people that are now getting back into looking at Russia, they need to keep in mind as we watch the rest of the year unfold?
Well, obviously the whole crisis with Crimea and Ukraine has been pretty much everybody's focus of attention since late February. Before that, everyone was focused on the Olympics, and that kind of, we all thought, the Russia watching community thought that we'd keep talking about the Olympics for at least a couple months, after they were over and about their impact and so forth. But instead, they just kind of disappeared, and we saw Russia's other side, as it were. So that's really been, I think, to the almost the exclusion of everything else since February. It's been the crisis, and we see how it's shaped relations between. It has ramifications in the economic sphere. It has ramifications in U.S.-Russian relations more generally. On other issues that we've been working with Russia on, such as Syria and Iran, non-proliferation, a lot of the space program, a lot of areas where the U.S. and Russia or EU and Russia have ties that have nobody's really paid much attention to, and now we're seeing, as some of those ties start to fray, we see just how interconnected Russia has become with the rest of the world.
The situation in Crimea and the Ukraine has similarities to what Russia has been up to in the last few years in Georgia and some of the other former Soviet republics, in that they keep carving out little spaces for various ethnic groups. Can you kind of discuss the background of how what they've been up to, or why they would carve out all these little semi-nations, if you will, in the middle of somebody else's country?
Sure. I mean, this has, I don't know how far back we want to go. This all goes back to, we could go back to Stalin's policies on ethnic minorities, but I'm not sure we want to do that. The slight, it goes a little bit closer to the present. The breakup of the Soviet Union, which, while much more peaceful than I think, at least initially, than anyone expected, did have some conflicts. And in the early stages, a lot of these ethnic territories that were carved out, as you say, weren't carved out by Russia. They were carved out through local conflicts. So Abkhazia and South Ossetia, for example, the ones in Georgia, were outside of Georgian control since the early 90s, after some fighting between those two groups and the Georgians that resulted in stalemates of various kind. At some point, one or the other side was closer to victory, but there was never a complete victory on either side, and certainly no international recognition of these enclaves. So that's kind of, and in addition to those two, there was also Transnistria and Moldova, and then Karabakh, which is an Armenian enclave in Azerbaijan. So those were kind of the four main ones that we had all through the 90s and through the, through the 2000s as well. And through the 90s, at least, Russia really didn't do much to support the sort of the unrecognized states, as it were. There were sort of various permutations in their policy. Sometimes they would try to conduct peace talks. Sometimes they would be more on one side or the other. But there was never a consistent policy of trying to, some people have this, divide these states in order to weaken them. That wasn't what was going on. It became more so under Putin. So then there was a little bit more of a engagement with trying to make sure, especially in Georgia, where after 2003, where an anti-Putin government took power, there was an effort to try to use the these enclaves to try to weaken the state, and the Georgian state, with culminating in the 2008 war between Russia and Georgia. But there's, well, I'll get to Crimea in a minute maybe. But there's one difference between all of those cases and what's going on now, which is that in no case were any of these territories annexed and made part of Russia. They're really, as far as territorial, you know, boundaries and territorial integrity, Russia was really seen as kind of a status quo power, willing to play these others for its foreign policy goals, but not looking to change the sort of post-Cold War settlement of, where the Soviet Union broke up and was divided into these 15 states. And so obviously 2014, we see a big change here where Crimea is annexed. And that is, I think, the most fundamental shift in Russia's reaction, sort of Russia's position maybe in the international system, where now we can at least consider Russia as potentially a revisionist power that might attempt to change boundaries elsewhere on its borders.
When you're talking about some of the ethnic conflicts that are involved here, when you look at the initial move into the Crimea, there was a lot of initial discussion concerning the Tartars, and I know you could spend an entire hour just talking about Stalin's ethnic deportations to Siberia after the Second World War, but I guess the executive summary is, when the and again, this goes back to the exact points you made, where do you want to draw the red mark on the timeline of who lives where? But the Tartars were in Crimea. Russia took it back in the 19th century. You had Stalin deport the Tartars after the fall of the Soviet Union. The Tartars have come back bits and pieces from Siberia. And from what I read and saw, the Tartars were perhaps, lack of a better phrase, pro-Ukrainian because they felt a little more secure with the government in Kiev. Do the Tartar minority remaining in Crimea, is that a potential problem for the Russians? Or are the Tartars more, lack of a better phrase, domesticated than the Chechens and some of the other ethnic groups that are giving the Russians trouble in the Caucasus right now?
I think they're no longer a potential problem. They're already, given the events of the last two or three days, which, maybe people haven't been paying as much attention to because of what's been going on in eastern Ukraine and in Odessa, it's already a problem. It's a problem because the sort of the leader of the Crimean Tatars, Mustafa Jemilev, has essentially been prohibited from entering Crimea in the last few days. And this has led, and he has attempted to enter both first by flying in, and he was refused permission to board the plane, there was an attempt to drive in from Ukraine into Crimea, and that was blocked as well. And at that point, there was he was met there from the Crimean side by I think several thousand Tatars who had come to meet him, and so then they staged a demonstration. There was also a concurrent, when it was made clear that he was not going to be allowed to enter, Crimean Tatars blocked main roads throughout Crimea for some period of time. I just saw today that there was an announcement by the Crimean authorities that they were going to initiate criminal charges against some of these people who were involved in these actions in Crimea. So there's a potential here for further escalation that could happen quickly, could happen over a longer period of time. but I think it's a big mistake for the Crimean authorities to, you know, to sort of, they essentially have kind of sought out this confrontation by banning Djemilev from entering Crimea. So, and now, what the response will be, it's hard to say. I'm not particularly an expert on the Crimean Tatars, so I don't know to what extent there's potential there for kind of violent action. I don't think there is, clearly not as much as the Chechens now, but one might say that when, you know, back in 1991, the Chechens didn't have such potential either, right? These things, you know, until Friday, everyone thought that Odessa was the most sort of tolerant and multicultural of cities, and that was the last place where there was going to be violence. Now there is a spiral of mutual condemnation and hatred because of violent acts that have happened. Same thing could happen with the Tatars. You know, it doesn't. You know, something happened. You know, there's Crimean self-defense force goes and clears out a Tatar shanty town, and there are some casualties. That could generate a response, or it could, you know, could go the other way around. The Crimean Tatars could attack something, and then that generate, you know, so these kinds of things can escalate, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks. They can escalate quite quickly, and in a place where, you know, with we're seeing hatred between Ukrainians and Russians, and not even, and even more so, in some cases, Russians living in Ukraine and Russians and other Russians living in Ukraine, because there are Russians in Ukraine who are pro-unity and who are opposed to the whole separatism and Putin and all that. So, and those are people who have cultural links and ties and have always been considered, you know, brothers, essentially, right? Tatars don't trust the Russians and haven't for decades. So there's even more likelihood there. What happens down the road is completely unpredictable, because it's all sort of depends on circumstances. You know, what happens? You know, somebody does something, and then we really kind of see the potential role of individual agency. You know, individuals who do something, and that really creates a path that could be in a completely different from what was the path that were available. You know, the week before.
I guess one of the questions I have is where Putin plans to go with this stuff. Is what is happening somewhat a response to the fact that the Ukrainians decided they would like to make a bid to join the EU? Does this upset his plan to have a Eurasian Union to counter the EU? Is there, you know, I can see why he might want Crimea because of the bases that are important to Russia, but is there, can you detect an end game in what he's up to, or is he just kind of tweaking the West here and seeing what he can get away with?
I think somewhere in between there. I'm not sure he knows what his end game is, right? Maybe we can divide this into a couple of things. There's clearly, you know, the causes for why this started. That, I think, is we can identify, you know, fairly clearly. There's a combination of what you said with, you know, this unwillingness to lose Ukraine in his perception, right, where some of the reason for the conflict has to go to the EU, because the EU kind of made this an either-or choice. For years and years, Ukraine existed in kind of a fragile stability because it could play both. Get as close as possible to Europe while also not alienating Russia. So, you know, try to relate to both both countries. There's a very nice, vivid expression that I heard a couple of months ago, which was that the Yanukovych government, his whole policy was for all, you know, all the years he was president, was to try to sit on the fence and try and milk the cows on both sides. So that's kind of where Ukraine was. And then, you know, but the EU, by saying, okay, if you want an association agreement with us, you really can't be part of Putin's Eurasian Union, while that obviously, you know, economically that may be the only that may be the only way to go, then you can't be in both. Politically, it created this zero-sum game that then Putin felt he had to win no matter what. So that's one part of it. There's a second part of it, which is the domestic calculations within Russia, which is that there's two things there. One is the example of protests leading to change in government is not something that Putin wants to appear as a good alternative within Russia. So, to the extent that the Maidan became a direct challenge to Putin's authority within Russia, and so that provoked a response. And the flip side is that since his popularity had been slipping for several years, this kind of nationalist move, annexing Crimea, you know, highlighting the hostility of Ukrainians to Russians, this kind of thing, has played very well in restoring his popularity. So his approval rating is higher than it has been in years. I think the last poll I saw was something like 82%. Because, you know, there's the rally around the flag effect that we are all familiar with, and then it works in Russia just like it works in, you know, it worked in the U.S. after 9/11. It works just about any country in the world if your country feels like it's threatened, whether or not it's actually being threatened. There's a tendency to support the leadership, and so those are all the kind of the factors that led him to do this. Now, none of those say anything about what the end game necessarily is, because I'm not sure he knows exactly what, you know, he's much more of a, I see Putin as more of a tactical thinker than a strategic one. So I think there is some element of seeing what, you know, what he can get away with without paying too high a cost. So, The move in Crimea was, in some way, you know, by creating these facts on the ground and occupying the peninsula, while at the same time doing it in a way, and I think this is sort of shows this, you know, the reason why these troops that were there didn't have Russian army insignia, for example, was the plausible deniability. If things went wrong, you could disavow the whole thing. They didn't go wrong, so then eventually, in the last few weeks, he's admitted that there were Russian troops involved. But now, you know, the world's attention has kind of moved on to other parts of Ukraine, and there their game is still being played, and it's being played in a very different way from the way it was played in Crimea. Rather than sending in troops, there's much more of a kind of a destabilization effort. And clearly, you know, to me at least, I know there's some folks that dispute this, but to me it seems quite clear that there are agents of Russian security services involved in creating these disturbances, they have popular support in some of the regions in Donetsk and Luhansk. There are certainly locals who are very much on their side, but I don't think, you know, it's kind of a firewood and matches kind of analogy. You need both to start a fire, and so there are, there are people there who are disaffected for various reasons or thought that the new government that was in place in Ukraine would negatively affect their interests, their business interests or their political interests, and so they're involved in these kind of separatist actions, but without the organization, without the sort of the spark, the example of Crimea, the agents coming in to help organize and to communicate and coordinate, it would almost certainly have all petered out, as it kind of did after in February. in the eastern Ukrainian oblast. But then Putin kind of sent in people to make sure the spark remained lit, and now we can now he doesn't need even to do much. They can probably even withdraw the agents, and these things kind of become self-sustaining, especially as there are casualties, which sort of feed that hatred and violence cycle, and allow it to continue. So where it ends up, I don't know. I'm really kind of depressed about prospects for Ukraine. I think it becomes, with every week where things just seem to escalate more and more, the prospects for Ukraine being both unified and peaceful at the end of this become lower and lower, and that's quite unfortunate.
Yeah, I share your mild depression-inducing feelings about it. I served with a couple of Ukrainians, a colonel and a major, for a few years, and there was a certain earnestness about them and their colleagues I ran into that they really wanted to get to as close to their Western colleagues in NATO as possible. And we had some interesting conversations about the Russians, kind of a cautious ambivalence that you almost see in a child who loves their uncle but fears him at the same time. I'll just throw out a planning assumption here. The old diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. Let's just take the military side and say that's not going to happen, worst-case scenario. So we're looking at the diplomatic, informational, and economic pushback from Ukraine and the supporters of Ukraine, NATO, and the West. We've already seen some economic sanctions come in, but I think that interdependency, not just in the energy sector, but in other areas, kind of has some caution, not just on the West, but also from the Russian point of view, because their economic balance and the money support for the Putin regime is very dependent on their resource extraction economy. And I'm curious of your perspective of how much economic flexibility does Russia have to do tit for tat. In the sanctions point of view, I think last week one of the more humorous points was when, I forget his name, but he's with the Russian Space Agency, he said, well, fine, go ahead and put me on the list. NASA can buy a trampoline to get its astronauts to the space station, which I guess that would be one of the low-hanging fruits for them to kind of fire back. But where are some areas from a Russian perspective that they need to be cautious, not only about sanctions that might be implied to might be imposed on them, but where they need to be cautious responding in kind?
Well, I mean, energy is obviously the big one, right? They've been working with the Chinese and to some lesser extent the Japanese to build more export routes in that direction, but that's all fairly, small compared. Russian energy export infrastructure is all kind of aimed at Europe, and it would take a lot of money and several years to shift it in a different direction. So if Europe were to, and here it's about Europe, not about the U.S. U.S. economic ties to Russia are there, and serious economic sanctions would be painful for a few U.S. companies, but they wouldn't really have a major impact on the U.S. economy. Whereas for Europe, there's because of the energy, there's much more mutual interdependence, and not just the energy, also in a lot of consumer sectors, there's a lot more investment from Europe in Russia. So for them, that's one of the reasons why Europe has been more cautious. But for Russia also, I think that's one of the reasons that they haven't pursued a more aggressive strategy, more overt strategy in Ukraine, let's say, because they don't want those level 3 sanctions, because that would really hurt the economy. Now, some would argue that they don't care that much because it would further strengthen the regime. It would be like, we're all in this together. You know, bad Westerners are trying to isolate this, so yes, times will be tough, but we'll all hang together, and, you know, we, like back in the Soviet days, we can just survive on our own. And, you know, if it comes down to it, I'm sure that that's the strategy the PR strategy they would use, but they don't want that. So, you know, they don't want it to get that bad. You know, because if the economy contracts, not only is it bad for people, it's also, you know, bad for financial flows to the corrupt leaders as well. So that's one area where I think there's a lot of reason for caution with Russia. Well, with the space program, I may be wrong here, but if I'm really followed it very closely, but my understanding was that the cooperation was kind of cut off already in one of these recent rounds of sanctions. So I may be wrong there, but I kind of thought that there was that was being curtailed. Now, how we're going to get people to the International Space Station, I'm not sure, but that is something, and that is an area where the U.S. needs Russia probably more than Russia needs the U.S. Because to the extent that and either side needs the other, I'm not sure. You know, to me, it seems like more and more space is kind of a sidelight for governments, at least. You know, it's not like in the 60s and 70s where it was really a prime prime drive for technological superiority. Now we have, in the U.S. at least, we have private companies doing space things, and that may be where things are headed as far as supplying the space station and so forth down the road. Other areas, we think, for Russia to be cautious. I mean, you know, they're still concerned about the potential for instability in Central Asia coming from Afghanistan. So they don't want to do anything that would, to the extent that there is cooperation with the U.S. on counterterrorism, on working against Islamic radicals, that sort of thing, they don't want to cut that off more than they have to, because that is something that they see as a benefit to themselves. Whether that's important enough to, if they see something as an existential threat to their regime, I think, they'll take whatever actions they need to and figure it's a cost that they can bear, but it is something that they prefer to avoid.
Well, I'm looking at a pipeline map from Russia to Europe, and it seems to me that if I were the Russians, that I would very much contemplate seizing the pipeline routes. Well, but then if they do that, what good does that do them? Will the Europeans ever unite and say, we don't want your gas because of what you're doing to the Ukraine?
It depends on the level. Not at the current level, right? I think if the Russian army goes into Ukraine tomorrow, they very well might. At least, enough. There might be enough of a push that it would be. There'd certainly be a number of viewpoints, but I think that Angela Merkel has certainly made. She's been out front in a way of her. A lot of her, the other Germans, so certainly of the business community in Germany, and she's been pushing a harder approach than the German business community has wanted. So I think that if we saw an escalation, there would be a push to do more. Now, I'm not sure what you mean by seizing the pipelines. I mean, a lot of the pipelines are, domestically, within Russia and also within, a lot of the other former Soviet countries, the pipelines are already owned by Russian companies. So there are...
What I meant was for them to put troops along the pipeline routes to prevent... I mean, if I were a Ukrainian defending my country, it wouldn't take me long to go attack pipeline systems, including the compression stations along the way where they get the gas to flow, if I wanted to really put a crimp into Russian economy.
Well, see, this is the thing that's so bizarre, is that as this is going on, right, Russia is still supplying Ukraine with gas, right? So they'd be sabotaging themselves as well. You know, if, and this is maybe one of the reasons why Russia has so far declined to stop shipping gas to Ukraine, is because they recognize that, you know, at that point the Ukrainians would have less to lose, and so they could very well attack the pipelines. They have been preparing for something along these lines for a while, or I don't think it was along these lines, but I think they decided they didn't want to be too dependent on Ukraine after, you know, the various pricing conflicts that they've had. And so they built alternative pipelines that don't go through, you know, the Nord Stream one, for example, that goes under the Baltic Sea and doesn't depend on any other country, and goes off to Germany. The South Stream isn't built yet, but it's similar, and it goes under the Black Sea. So those are all designed to reduce dependence on these transit countries, and you know that's for Russia, you know, the way they're planning to deal with the problem. But if the EU chooses to sanction Russia and stop shipments of Russian gas, that's not gonna, you know, then it doesn't matter what countries the pipelines do or don't go through. You know, it will still have, you know, that impact on both, on the economies of both sides. One thing that I think we should at least mention that may not be on people's radar is the connection between the Putin regime on the one hand and some of the nationalist and far-right parties in the EU. So Putin has in the last maybe 4 or 5 years formed an alliance, you know, sort of cultivated, I guess is the right word, parties like the French National Front, Marine Le Pen's party, the Jobbik, which is a far-right party in Hungary that has a fair bit of support. So a lot of these kind of, the harder line anti-immigrant far-right parties in Western Europe have been kind of supportive of Putin's position on a lot of these issues, on the Ukraine conflict in the last few months. And part of that is because of these ties that they have been built up over the years. And so that's just something that I think a lot of people don't really realize. And it's, you know, sort of people think, oh, why would what's the connection there? But a lot of it has to do with these kind of defending traditional values and, being opposed to decadent liberalism and that sort of thing. Where the parties find common ground. There's also been connection. There are some connections between Putin kind of people, not Putin directly, but people around Putin and some of the sort of the Christian right, not the neocons, in the U.S. I mean. Not the neocons, but the kind of the traditional values and moral, the ones for whom values and morality issues are most important. There have been some links, documents.
Yeah, I read a very strange article by Pat Buchanan that was really kind of pro-Putin a few weeks ago.
So
you've seen that here and there. It's very peculiar.
Yeah, and that's where it's coming from. It's this kind of defending, you know, I mean, for Russia, it's defending Orthodox values, but, you know, they're happy to make it a little broader and say Christian values. And you know, that really ties in with a lot of these folks who are opposed to, you know, like, opposed to gay marriage, and, you know, they were, you know, when there was the whole Pussy Riot issue a couple of years ago, that was, you know, that was a place where they found common ground as well. So these kind of actions that are seen as blasphemous or decadent in some way are areas where there's common ground. So you see these kind of interesting in the U.S., you see these very interesting types of people who come out to a greater or lesser extent defending Putin's actions. One, you know, one we've discussed these kind of the Christian right, but then you also have the more traditional kind of left. You know, defending Putin from the left as a sort of an opponent of American imperialism, right? This I'm thinking like The Nation kind of magazine, folks who were in a way, you know, they did the kind of very similar kind of thing in the Cold War period, and so this is kind of continuing that. But the right is entirely new. I don't think there was anyone in the Christian right who was defending the Soviet Union in the 80s, but you do see that now that, you know, there's no more anti-religion, but instead Putin kind of drapes himself in religious values, and so that makes it a more feasible alliance.
It is really a strange stew where, you know, you even have situations where the pro-Russian hard right is in the Crimea was against the right sector hard right in Ukraine.
Yep.
I wonder if you could help a lot of our listeners understand, and no play off the Orthodox values, but some of the iconography that we've seen in the last few months has been peculiar. And I think one of the things, there are two things that stick out the most. I wonder if you could help people understand about, you know, the strange mix of, you know, one Slavic people, Russians, Belarusians, Ukrainians. And, you know, one of the things that kicked off early on in Ukraine was when they attacked the statue of Lenin in downtown Kiev, which kind of shocked me. I was like, why do they still have a Russian communist up there? And the second iconography that came up is a colonel, I think all military professionals would respect, Colonel Yuli Manshor, if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, the Ukrainian Air Force, when he led his regiment unarmed to march on the gates to try to take the base back from the Russian special forces pretending to be locals in the Crimea, is as he was marching towards the gate, on his left, you had the Ukrainian flag with its nice Swedish colors. And then on his right, you had the regiment flag. And on the regiment flag, the Ukrainian Air Force regimental flag, was the hammer and sickle, which I assume dated back to when that regiment was part of the Soviet Air Force. And so you see this mix of pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian all seem to, in one step or another, be touching on some communist symbiology. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, has a lot of what in the West we might consider communist symbols turned into more nationalist symbols, where somebody like Lenin is Russian, and the hammer and sickle for some people is less Russian, but can be associated with local events as well. It's just very peculiar, that mix. I don't know if you could help flesh that out for people.
Sure. Well, a couple of things. Let me address the my mom tour and the Crimean arrangement, because that was actually an interesting action. That wasn't, as far as I know, that wasn't the actual current regiment flag. That they had deliberately taken out the regiment. You know, every regiment has its flags from, you know, if it has a history, it has its old flags, right, in the regiment museum or wherever it is, And so they took out the World War II era flag and marched with it. And in fact, you could hear them, you know, when the guards had, you know, were pointing their rifles at them as they were marching closer. They said, "Are you really going to shoot our, you know, the World War II? You know, we have this flag, which is a symbol of us all being brothers and serving together. And are you really going to shoot at the World War II flag?" And, you know, I don't know if that was the main thing that made it work, but it worked, and they negotiated, and eventually some of them were allowed into the base in certain parts of it. So that was very much a deliberate kind of strategic choice to use that symbolism because it united the two sides. So rather than, you know, marching with some other, you know, their regiment flag from, you know, 2014, which may not have anything in common. But the general point, I think, is an interesting one as well, which is that I think the communist symbols, we should, I mean, for Americans, maybe, we always think, oh, the Russians, right? From the, you know, the Soviets and the Russians were kind of used interchangeably all through the Cold War. But that's not the way they think of it. So those symbols are not Russian symbols. They're communist symbols, right? They're Soviet symbols. And so the statue of Lenin is not a Russian communist. He's a communist, right? And so the reason why a lot of statues of Lenin were left up in various places, not just in Ukraine, but in various parts of Russia and all sorts of former Soviet countries. I think there's, if I remember correctly, I think there's one in Kyrgyzstan. Is that to take it down is to make a political statement against communism, which, while, you know, that a lot of them were taken down in, let's say, 1991, afterwards, as things didn't go so well and there was a lot of more nostalgia for the Soviet period among especially the older population, that was a political statement that would alienate a certain segment of your electorate, let's say, even if it wasn't a democracy, a certain segment of the population that you didn't necessarily need to alienate. So it was easier to just leave it there and let it be, and the people who, you know, cared about the Soviet Union would come and lay flowers on whatever days, and that would be fine, and everyone else could ignore it. And so that's kind of the reason why I think a lot of those communist symbols have stayed. And so then taking them down, while, you know, people who were taking them down were very much opposed to these ties to other former Soviet republics, right? That was the whole, you know, it was the reason why it was called the Euromaidan, right? It was about joining Europe and getting away from the former Soviet countries. And so taking them down was a symbolic act that of separation of Ukraine from Russia. And that's why it was seen as so hostile, you know, so on a symbolic level, in Russia, because it was interpreted in this way as intended. I think that it was as an act of breaking the bonds with that you know previously united Ukrainians and Russians.
Yeah, somewhat. I've been reading, obviously, a bunch of stuff on this, but one of the things that really surprises me about this is the demographic issues that Russia has, and it's, you know, it's kind of relegation, as some people have said, to a regional power or regional power plus, or, you know, that it's geopolitically very weak. Is this effort somewhat the Putin's last gasp to try and grasp something more than relegation to a regional power?
I don't know. I mean, that may be a way of looking at it. I'm thinking of it more as a you know, on the so there are a bunch of sort of lenses through which we can look at. There's the local lens of, you know, that we talked about with, you know, trying to keep Ukraine integrated, and the domestic lens. This particular lens is the sort of the international system, right? Like, what does it say about where Russia fits in? And I think it has, to the extent that that's relevant, I think it's more about a belief in the Russian elite that the whole sort of the U.S.-led system is stacked against Russia. You know, whether, you know, I don't know if it really matters, you know, whether it's region, you know, they want to consider themselves regional or superpower or whatever. But the way things are set up in a way, you know, this is from the Russian point of view, set up in a way that when the U.S. does things that violate international norms, they're excused or ignored. Whereas if other countries do things like that, then they are punished. And that's sort of to the extent that the system is set up this way, I think perhaps Putin thought that there's a way to try to change the system so that, at least for Russia, so that it's seen as, you know, it's no longer seen as an actor that can be ignored or dismissed whenever the U.S. is dealing with some international issue, right? And there's this whole, you know, if you ask Russians who are, you know, focused on this kind of thing, there's a whole litany of flights that, you know, going back to, I mean, at least to Kosovo, if not earlier, where, you know, Russian interests were ignored, or Russian views were dismissed. Every time Russia tried to sort of get, you know, be show its worth in the system, it was, you know, it's what it saw as its concessions, or I don't know if concessions is the right word, but what it was trying to provide, the benefits it was trying to provide to the U.S. were taken as kind of something that the U.S. should get in due course, and then there was no return benefits provided. So I'm thinking like the whole post 9/11 providing bases, allowing the U.S. to have bases in Central Asia. That was not something, you know, instead of kind of building on that and creating some kind of joint security system, Bush's next move was to drop out of the ABM treaty and start building a ballistic missile defense. And then Iraq, which, you know, again, Russian objections were dismissed. And why should the U.S., you know, again, you know, Russian point of view, why should the U.S. have the right to go and unilaterally or with a coalition of the willing pursue regime change in Iraq? And, you know, we can't do that in Georgia or Ukraine or somewhere. Or Libya, where Russian support for no-fly zone was then, again, from the Russian point of view, twisted into carte blanche for attacks that led to overthrow of Gaddafi. So that kind of thing was kind of this litany of all these slights that led to Russian elites sort of deciding that maybe we can change the system in some way that would give us more of a role. And you know, it's worked to the extent that now everyone's paying attention to Russia. You know, whether, you know, if you can't get good attention, you get bad attention, right? But at least everyone's taking Russia's position into account now.
Yeah, I'm glad you rolled the clock all the way back to Kosovo, because one of the more intriguing pictures I saw on, I think it was Friday, hanging over one of the pro-Russian barricades in southeastern Ukraine, I forget which city it was in, next to two icons was a picture of all people, Slobodan Milosevic. So,
sure.
Yeah, the memory is there. The memory is absolutely there. You know, we've been talking about externally stuff, and yes, believe it or not, I do listen to NPR on occasion. And in the last week, they're interviewing a few people, and what they brought is that, no, let's talk about what's going on inside of Russia right now. And they were discussing how last decade or so there have been some high-profile assassinations of overly inquisitive members of the press. In more recent years, there's been a steady crackdown on opposition and freewheeling press. And we even have seen some of the more, we would consider blogs or web magazines, have just been plain shut down. And you roll that in with the anti-gay laws from last year, and they were discussing some anti-swearing laws that have come into play recently. Inside of Russia, what is Putin building that will survive his, you know, mortal existence? Are we going to see Russia trending more towards a Chinese-type system without a communist party? Or is this part of the sop to the traditional orthodox values that we were discussing before?
Well, it's hard to, you know, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, past Putin, right, we're talking probably, you know, 10 or 15 years at least, unless there's some violent act, right? I mean, he's not that old. So it's hard to know exactly where things will go. I think the China model is one that they would like people to think they are aspiring to, but there's one big difference. Which is that in China, the leadership is not there for life, right? Every 10 years, it's not democratic, but there's a rotation. The old leaders go out, the new leaders come in. As we saw in last year, that can sometimes lead to some, you know, fairly public disputes and shakeups, and people get put on trial and that sort of thing. Without that, so Russia doesn't have that. Russia, it seems that, you know, this current group is there and they want to stay there until, as long as they can. And that is combined, or maybe, I don't know if it encourages, certainly, but it's also just combined with a much higher level of corruption. You know, there's plenty of corruption in China, but it's not quite to the level, you know, where, you know, in Russia and it's kind of like, I mean, we saw this in Ukraine with the Yanukovych regime, where, you know, there's just, you know, sort of a wholesale, you know, diversion of resources to the leadership from the public, you know, the public good. And, you know, it's easier to get away with it in Russia versus Ukraine because the country is just wealthier. So, you know, in Ukraine, 5 years of that brought, you know, even before Maidan and the instability and all this, the 5 years of this kind of this level of corruption brought the country to, you know, the brink of default. Russia has much more in the way of resources, so it doesn't get there as fast. But the economy was set to decline this year anyway, before any sanctions, before any instability, before anything else. So as far as what he's building, you know, I don't think it's not a long-range, you know, it's not a system that's built for long-range, you know, long-term success. It's a system that's built for the short-term survival, you know, the short-term benefit and survival as long as possible of the current elite.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And on that note, we've used up about an hour of your time, and probably go on for several more hours. what kind of projects you got coming out, and what can we look forward to coming from you in the next few weeks?
Well, I'm working on a study of Russian strategy in the Arctic that I think might probably sometime in the summer it'll be out. I'm still, you know, trying to keep up on the Russian military. Interestingly enough, I was invited to attend the Russian MOD's international conference, which will be in a couple of weeks in Moscow. So I'm going to go there and see what I can, kind of try to get a sense of, what they're talking about, what they're thinking about. It should be very different from previous such conferences I've attended, given the
that
changes.
Is going to be an interesting conference. That's going to be great.
Yeah, usually, in the past, the U.S. and various countries have sent delegations to these conferences, and this year they're not, so for obvious reasons. So it'll be, I think it'll be interesting to see. There are a few kind of academics and policy analyst types who are going from the U.S. So I think we'll have an interesting time seeing what's going on. So that's what I'm working on now. I'm sort of have a longer range idea of looking at. Given your audience, you might be interested in down the road is looking at Russia's maritime strategy in the Pacific. That's project I hope to get underway maybe in the fall. So,
well, I can see two distinct reasons that we need to have you on more, Dmitry. We'd love to have you on. Combine your visit to Russia with the work you've been doing on the Arctic, which obviously maritime people are very interested in, and absolutely if you start picking around the Russian Pacific strategy, because I know they're not going to let the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Americans have all the fun. We'll definitely have to track you on that, because that would be a great discussion. I look forward to it.
Yeah, and I'll be as far as the Russian MOD conference, I will be writing that up on my blog, whatever I find, so people can look for it there.
Absolutely, and that is the Russian military reform. And our guest this hour is Dr. Dmitry Gorenberg. He is a senior analyst in CNA Strategic Studies. And in addition to Russian Military Reform Blog, he's an associate at the Harvard Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and an author. And we really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to come on. I look forward to next time, Dmitry.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks a lot, sir. Dmitry.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us. We hope everybody has a great week and a good Mother's Day next week. And until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.